Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is August 20th, 2012. What you're going to hear is hour one from the August 9th show today. And I have a couple of brand new voices on the live show and new faces, depending on how you consume the live show. Video has faces. So you might have seen a little bit of this on YouTube already. I've been working on some sound quality issues. I'm not really happy with the sound quality. And what I discovered was the program we were using to record sucks. And I've fixed that problem. So when you hear the next show, the August 16th show with Bob Murphy, many of those problems will be resolved. It's not perfect yet, but we are getting there. Now, here's the story with this show, and this is why you're only hearing hour one today. Eventually, hour two will be available. But I had a couple of special guests come on because I thought they would be the perfect people to explore the topic of youth, really young people, because this goes on beyond school, the disempowerment of young people and some ways to overcome that. The first segment of the live show is now devoted to something called getting to know your cognitive biases. And I'll talk about what all that is in the show, but I will give you a definition. A cognitive bias is a pattern of deviation in judgment that occurs in particular situations, leading to perceptual distortion, inaccurate judgment, illogical interpretation, or what is more broadly called irrationality. I've been taking these first segments from the last few weeks and just putting them aside, and eventually on the new website, I'm going to release them all in one place. So every 10-minute clip will be a different cognitive bias. There's over 100, and I think for improving our communication with others, cognitive biases are an important thing to understand. But this time in this show, I'm going to include the one we covered, which was called confabulation, because at the beginning of the second segment, I got a call from a former public school teacher who wanted to discuss memory and how people remember school. And that conversation took us through the first hour. And it was also built off our discussion about that cognitive bias, confabulation. So we didn't really get to explore the topic that I wanted to explore on the show in as much detail as I would have liked. So I'm going to put hour two aside for right now. And when I have these same guests on in the future, and I will, we will explore that topic to completion. That's it for today. I hope you enjoy this. I have another show coming soon with Bob Murphy from the Mises Institute. And that should be out in just a couple of days. Thanks for listening and take care. Everybody, and welcome to School Sucks Live for August 9th, 2012. I'm Brett, and with me in the studio tonight, two people making their School Sucks Radio debut. First, we have Celestina. How you doing?
Hello, I'm good.
And Celestina is my girlfriend. Yeah. And then we also, next to her, we have one of my regular male friends, Kirk.
Not Brett's girlfriend.
Thank you.
I wouldn't say regular.
So
extra large.
Many of you are sitting at home saying, Brett, is this what you do? You just have your little friends on the show all the time and you guys sit there and chat? No, we have two very qualified people tonight. Both have radio and podcast experience and both perfect guests for the topics that we are going to get into tonight. But the first segment of the show is now devoted to is getting to know your cognitive biases. I think that's a nice name. Now, there's over 100 cognitive biases. So this is something that we're probably going to be doing for, into 2014 or so. But we started out with a subcategory. The categories, again, of cognitive biases are social biases, memory biases, decision-making biases, and probability and belief biases. And we are on memory biases. We have done suggestibility. Last week we did one called reminiscence bump, and that is a phenomenon where people, when they reach middle age, seem to be able to recall a disproportional amount of memories from their late teens into their early 20s. And one of the theories about why reminiscence bump occurs is because that is a period in our lives where we are making a lot of new memories. We're having a lot of novel experiences. Job, college, sex, that kind of thing. First relationship, maybe a marriage, maybe a child is born. So people, the memory seems to make more room and have more activity for that period of our lives. Now, tonight, we are moving on to our third memory bias. It is called confabulation.
It's a wonderful name. I'm going to give you the definition. We're going to talk about it just a little bit. Confabulation is a memory disturbance that is characterized by verbal statements and or actions that inaccurately describe history, background, and present situations. Confabulation is considered honest lying, but distinct from lying because there's typically no intent to deceive and the individual is unaware that their information is false. Although patients can blatantly present false information, called a fantastic confabulation, confabulatory information can also be coherent, internally consistent, and relatively normal. So you guys confabulators?
Oh, all the time. Absolutely.
Now that you know, I think that there's so many kinds of errors when we have conversations, you know, we might catch ourselves doing it, or we can be aware of other people doing it. But we say, well, what is that? That doesn't make any sense. But it happens too fast in a conversation to say, wait a minute. Either I didn't make any sense or that person didn't make any sense. But to understand and be able to define some of these things, I think is very helpful.
Sure. And I think sometimes it just takes place as those little leaps in conversation where someone doesn't fully fill in the information, but they assume that you know where they're going. And it's because of their own cognitive biases that they think, oh, well, this person's probably coming from the same place that I am. Obviously, we're going to come to the same logical conclusion. It doesn't always work out that way.
And the place where you file memories and the place where you create memories in the brain kind of overlaps. The same neurons are firing or whatever in the same places. It's kind of scary. Like, if humans are so prone to this, it does make you wonder, what am I not remembering correctly?
Right.
I get into it with my sister all the time where we're remembering details of, like, our family history very differently.
So that could be some of the other cognitive biases playing into that as well. And especially, you know, if two people are considerably different ages, you know, they might have formed the memories in a totally different state, less emotional, more emotional, depending on what was going on. So, yeah, I wanted to give some attributes of this. So maybe if we flesh this out a little bit better, people can identify with it. Characteristic features of confabulation, typically verbal statements, but can also be nonverbal gestures or actions, can include autobiographical and non-personal information such as historical facts, fairy tales, or other aspects of semantic memory. The account can be fantastic or coherent. Both the premise and the details of an account can be false. The account is usually drawn from, they're using the word patient as if this is something that is usually treated in psychotherapy. The account is usually drawn from the patient's memory of actual experiences, including past and current thoughts. The patient is unaware of the account's distortions or inappropriateness and is not concerned when errors are pointed out.
What does that mean?
Again, does it have like an emotional component to it? Do they need their confabulations?
Well, that would make sense if they're not concerned at all. They're just glossing over the fact that, oh, well, yeah, but maybe I misremembered that. But here, I'm going on with my story.
Right. Or is it they're not even hearing the errors that you're pointing out?
Let me read it one more time. The patient is unaware of the account's distortions or inappropriateness and is not concerned when errors are pointed out.
It's kind of vague.
Yeah. So almost like maybe it sounds like they might not believe it. Like, no, this is my memory. And before the show started, we were talking about eyewitness testimony.
Right.
And it's funny that eyewitness testimony is actually considered to be one of the more reliable things. Like when a case is being prepared against somebody, they say, oh, eyewitness, we need an eyewitness. But all kinds of things can distort. And it's not just like, how far away were you? Do you wear glasses? Did you have a beverage? You know, those kinds of factors. There's all kinds of contributory factors that can change a person's memory. And when we think about some of the other cognitive biases that exist, like the one we talked about in the first week was called suggestibility. When a person is put into an emotional state, somebody can actually feed them information. And from that, they can form this new idea that isn't true, that isn't something that they remembered, but they've come to believe it almost like an automaton just from being programmed with that information in an emotional state. So you think about somebody on the stand for the prosecution testifying against a defendant with that kind of pressure, with that kind of intimidation from a prosecutor in that situation, could they make a memory that serves the prosecution? It's interesting to think about. Also, no hidden motivation behind the account. So there's no conscious reason for engaging in confabulation. And the last one, the patient's personality structure may play a role in their readiness to confabulate. So identifying all this is helpful, but can you recall any experiences where you were having a conversation with somebody and you knew that they were recalling, like, let's say, historical information?
Sure.
And they're totally talking about something that never happened, or they're completely distorting their recount of what happened.
I think one of the easiest examples for me on this, and I would imagine a lot of your audience can identify with this, when you're listening to two relatives at a family reunion or a family dinner or something like that talk about the same event, where they both bullet pointed in their memory different mm-hmm. things. So maybe the potato salad was for some reason significant to Aunt so-and-so, but the fact that Bob broke his arm playing football was particularly important to Uncle Tom or something like that. They bullet pointed all these different things in their own memory, and what they wound up doing was stringing these events together in a way that made sense to them, even though they're making up the transitions between their own bullet pointed memories.
Interesting. So that's confabulation. We will continue with our topic in just a few minutes. Stick with us. This is School Sucks Live. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett. And with me in the studio tonight, we have Celestina and Kirk. And I'm glad you guys are here. Some of the things that we're going to get into tonight are areas where both of you, I think, have had a lot of experience. You, as somebody, Celestina, has tried to start a business. You've been in a union.
Tell anyone. I'm kidding.
But it's going to be so helpful for our conversation. But we don't have to get into that right away. And like any new idea that I want to try on the show, it always takes some experimenting. It takes some refining. And I always I said we were going to keep it to one segment on our cognitive biases. But we got a teacher on the phone named John, and he's calling from Hawaii, and he had a comment based on what he heard us talking about in the first segment. So, John, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm right here.
All right, you sound great. What's on your mind tonight?
I was listening to what you were talking about, and you know, I think this concept happens with people when they're remembering their educational experiences all the time. People in the classroom, they tend to gloss over all of the experiences that could be perceived as negative and other things that are shaping them, and they tend to accept what society tells them they should feel about their education. Does that make sense?
Well, this is the experience that I had, the feeling that I had in middle school and maybe to a lesser extent in high school. I remember this emotion being very strong when I was in middle school. Too bad that's the way it is. Oh, it really sucks that things are this way because I would really like it if they were different. But obviously, yeah, I felt constrained and boxed by the rules of the school and what I just thought were, you know, for lack of a better description, the mainstream expectation for people and especially for young people's behavior. So if that sounds like what you're talking about, I think I've definitely had that experience. And I just want to ask the people in the room here with me, you guys.
So do you think that people look back on a school more fondly than it actually was? Is that what you're saying? Like, do you think that teachers remember public school as being good, and that's why they become public school teachers? Ooh. Because they were told it's good.
John?
I think they look on the institution as being good because that's what they've always been told, and that's just part of the mythology that everybody learns. But maybe not their experiences have been good, and so that cognitive dissonance often drives a lot of people into teaching. I mean, that's basically what made me choose this career path.
And how long ago was that for you?
I would say I started teaching in 2000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been teaching for about 12 years now.
And what have you learned in that time?
Wow.
You know, I mean, generally speaking, I know that's a very broad question as far as you sound. If you're listening to this show and you're not outraged, it sounds like you've learned quite a bit, right?
Yeah. Well, I started teaching. My first teaching job was then at an alternative school in Minnesota, and this school taught mostly adjudicated youth and people who had some serious dysfunction in the system already, and then and not just in the school system but in society system. You know, they had run into some serious problems. So that was an eye-opening experience. I mean, I'm from a rural town in Minnesota. And, you know, we had a pretty monoculture there, and everyone was pretty much the same. And so this was the first time I was really been thrust into an experience where you had all kinds of different minority groups and all kinds of different kinds of people, and some people who had some serious problems. So that kind of opened my eyes to what it was like, what the rest of the world could be like. You know, it's a lot more complicated than that. After that, you know, I taught mainly high school science, and I got into, you know, some other kinds of teaching aspects as well. I ended up moving out to Hawaii in 2008, and I ended up leaving the public schools and moving to the private schools because, you know, I was exposed to John Taylor Gatto's work, and that really kind of blew my mind away, you know, and made me question what I was doing in the public schools, and, you know, just what kind of effect I could be. You know, I think that the straw that broke the camel's back is in Minnesota, we had a Minnesota comprehensive test, and those are all for No Child Left Behind. And the test they were rolling out at the time that I was deciding what I was going to do was they were going to have a Minnesota basic skills test in history.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was like, okay, so now we have government approved history.
Oh, so sure.
That's kind of how that was the big wake up call for me that I had to make a change. And in Hawaii, they have so many different options for private schools out here, and different kinds of private schools. It was a very interesting place to move, just because if there was a way to try and see how the free market approach could appeal to a whole bunch of different kinds of students, you're more likely to find it out here rather than in Minnesota or even anywhere in the mainland. From my experience, the public school system out here is so terrible that most parents who have any ability at all are looking for some kinds of options for their kids. And so what we have out here are schools that tend to specialize in what parents want.
Daddy! Interesting. Are you a parent yourself?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, you might have heard the backdrop.
How much did that contribute to you know, your moving away from public school? Because I think, you know, what we were talking about and constructing the memories that we need, I shouldn't say we, but people make these memories or have these beliefs, and these beliefs that they hold on to, the beliefs that they need a lot of the time to keep continuing to do the things that they do. And I mean, I was viciously attacked about a year ago when the whole Wisconsin Union thing was going on. And I wanted to get into some Facebooks and have some dialogue with people, maybe get some guests out of it. And I mean, I was sent threatening emails and called names for even challenging the institution itself, even being willing to question the institution. So I think when somebody has children and then you see your own child going into that system, I mean, this might not be your experience at all, but you see your own child going into that system, did that contribute to your change in thinking at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I think about children as, you know, parents as being, you know, stewards of our children. And if you're going to be a good steward, you know, they should be able to look back on the kinds of decisions that you made, you know, for them, and be able to thank you for the things that you did, you know, and wanting to, you know, to say, you know what, I'm really glad that you made some of these decisions for me. You know, I mean, eventually they're going to have to start making decisions for themselves as they learn how to step into that field of self-ownership.
Right. John, we got a break. I'll hold on to you for another segment. This is School Sucks Live. We will be right back. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live for August 9th, 2012. I want to jump right back to the phone. We have John. He is a teacher in Hawaii. John, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm right here.
All right. I wanted to bring Kirk into the conversation first because he actually has, Kirk, you have two
very
wise beyond their years daughters who are in the public schools.
They are, in fact. Actually, one of the things that John mentioned that kind of struck a chord with me was his background and where he came from, growing up in a rural school system. And it made me wonder, and I have no statistics on this right this second. I haven't found anything here on my computer just during the break. But it's interesting to me how many teachers I have just observed personally who come from suburban or rural school districts themselves. They had a reasonably positive experience. They sort of heard those normal, quote-unquote, normal cultural stories from middle America about how school was good and this sort of thing, and they became teachers. John, would you say that's your experience, too, that most of the public school teachers that you met were sort of from that suburban or rural, you know, middle-class America?
Yeah, I would say that's probably, you know, that describes the majority of the teachers that I've met. I mean, for me, it was pretty much the opposite experience. I am a pretty creative person, and I've never really fit into the school mode very much. And one of the things I wanted to do in being a teacher was to help students who also didn't fit into that kind of mold, and to try and reach out in a whole bunch of different ways to see if I could help a whole bunch of different kinds of people. So, I mean, that's my experience. My negative experience in school really kind of propelled me into trying to make it positive for more different kinds of people.
Sure. And that makes sense. And one of the thoughts that led me to was how, if you take a subject like history, for example, how history today is not so much taught as a series of facts and dates. It's taught as sort of this story arc of people. And it creates this sort of mythos of, you know, here's the great American experiment, or here's the story of American exceptionalism, or the story of Western civilization. And even if you go all the way back to Themistocles with Greek history, it's always been sort of a story of people, but it's always of the mainstream people as opposed to all the various groups that made up the actual history and the actual day-to-day life of these different cultures. And so it interests me that the more I thought about this, the more teachers are coming from that mainstream, and then they're sort of augmenting that story arc, if you take my meaning.
Yeah, well, when I first started teaching, I was a flaming liberal, and I think that's probably common of most teachers. You know, not in the sense that every single one is liberal, but in one sense they believe in the state, they believe in government, and they believe in the power and the rightness of government. So they accept that mythology, and that's something that. That's something that I kind of fell away from after reading Gatto's work and seeing how everyone was being shaped and molded by the state, you know, and being kind of an individualist, you know, I started to see things from a different perspective about 5 or 6 years ago, and that's changed my whole approach to education.
Sure, and it's easy to get into that mode where you say, you know, gosh, I have this new perspective. I have this new idea. I'm going to share that new idea with everybody. And the difficult thing sometimes is to step back away from that and realize that whether or not you're sharing the state's idea or your idea, if all you're doing is sharing the idea and not the ability to process the facts,
right,
then you're just another person sharing that idea. And I'm not criticizing you specifically, John, but this is something that I've heard a variety of people talk about.
And, you know, John, you sound like me if I was a guy named John.
I was thinking that. He sounds exactly like you're having your experience.
It is almost like we have had the exact same experience. You know, I started in a school for quote-unquote troubled youths, and I wanted to be the teacher who was different, you know, who broke the rules. I was very liberal, and turns out, as far as, you know, robbing people of the opportunities to think for themselves, even though I tried to be conscious of this, and we actually talked about this in the last
show, I followed the rules of school in that respect, because it was top down. It was my way. Yes, let's have a discussion and then we'll round it back up and I'll tell you how it really is. So I'm just amazed by how similar your story is.
I think a lot of teachers, it's not so much that they had a good experience, but they remember maybe like one or two people out of like a mess of terrible people that just changed their life. And then they want to become that person. They want to be that mentor to a whole group of students. Like, it's a very powerful thing, you know, thinking you're going to be that person that's going to change lives, just like this person that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life changed mine.
Yeah. And I think the other thing too with that is that's also how people deal with their anxiety about government institutions, especially school, is they say, well, you know, in fifth grade, I had Mr. Reynolds and he was, you know, he helped me and he stayed after and he did Cub Scouts or whatever. Yeah, I have an uncle like this who, you know, if someone's in a costume waving a gun around, they're a good guy. That kind of progressive liberal point of view, statist point of view. You know, he would defend the school system by cherry picking these very selected, isolated memories of one or two people. Now, you couldn't defend dentistry that way, right? If you had been to 60 dentists and one of them wasn't terrible, dentistry is not a good thing. You know what I mean? But I certainly understand how a teacher can tell themselves a story. I did exactly the same thing. What Celestina said is exactly what I did. I hated almost every teacher that I ever had and was so unimpressed with almost all of them, with very, very few exceptions before I got to college. And then it was one history professor who was a socialist who totally changed my direction. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a teacher.
Yeah, it's interesting, Brett. I've listened to your podcast, and I think I've listened to every episode now. I hope that doesn't sound creepy, but
it's just but anyway. Much, much more dedicated than me.
No, I mean, it's not creepy at all. Go ahead, Sean.
It's the philosophy that's interesting, you know, and the different things that you're bringing up, because you know, I've done a lot of research. Just on my own about this after reading Gatto's work and trying to explore some of the primary sources myself, you know, and trying to dig down to the bottom of what my own feelings about my own profession are right now. But, you know, I would say regarding this conversation, it's that mythology that forms around people's experiences, you know, that are informed by, you know, those few good experiences. And I think people, they tend to focus on that. But then when you point out all of the coercion that happens inside of this, of the schools, that's when the cognitive dissonance happens. And that's when, you know, people will clam up. And you experienced this, you know, with a lot of the negative feedback that you were getting right around the time that the whole Wisconsin thing was going on. You know, I mean, you're basically bringing up the coercion. And once you start bringing that up, and once you start bringing up the experience, the real experience of the students in the schools and what they go through, that dissonance, you know, I don't know what it would take, how strong of a person it would take to try and hammer through that and think about, you know, and think about the whole profession in a different way.
Yeah, well, I think it distorts so many of our the experiences that people have within school, because it's all based on force. It's all based on coercion, which is why in one of my first podcasts, I retell the story of me starting a business where the only difference is this time I wave a gun around at people that I want to do business with. And boy, does it change a lot of things. John, I'm enjoying this conversation. I want to hold you for the last segment of the first hour. Can you stick with us? We can talk a little more.
Sure.
Great. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. I'm Brett. With me tonight is Celestina and Kirk. And we have John on the phone. He is a teacher out in Hawaii, and we've had him on for three segments. I'm enjoying this because he's telling the story of my career, but he had it too. John, you still there? I can hear you.
Yeah, I'm here.
So, Celestina, you had a question that you wanted to ask.
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering what you're doing with your children. What's their education like?
Well, we've been experimenting with different kinds of schools out here in Hawaii. I mean, I'm a teacher, and what I'd ideally like to find is a kind of school that nurtures their independent spirit and helps teach them some things that are going to be important. That whole project is evolving, and I don't really have a complete answer as to what eventually will happen to them. But right now they're going to the school that I work at, and I'm fairly happy with, you know, what's going on there. Our school is a private school, and we tend to focus on the individual child, and we try to give them as much freedom within the institution as possible. But still, you know, going back to that mythology, the people there, my colleagues, you know, they still buy into the mythology of schools itself, you know, and when I try and have conversations with some of my colleagues about that mythology and questioning some of the basic tenets of school, it doesn't go very well, you know, and I've learned that it's kind of like Stockholm syndrome, you know, where people they start to fall in love with the people that have aggressed against them, and those few good
We know what you mean.
Yeah, I always say that all of childhood is pretty much like Stockholm syndrome, not just public school.
Sure, and in Vegas you have to pay double for that stuff.
You know, but even in a place where we consciously focus on trying to make the learning experience different for the child and give them more individuality and as much freedom as possible, we still run up against those walls of this mythology where people feel hemmed in. And so when I suggest that, you know, we need to take it a step further and give them more freedom to study some different things, you know, and not have as much required content. We don't really focus on that. We're focusing more on thinking skills, but they still, you know, there's certain lines that just they can't be pushed or budged anymore, because there you get people to the limit of that mythology and they're right at the edge of that box and
right.
They just
right.
Can't make that last step out.
Is it the government regulations, or is it just the teachers are so set in their ways? Like, how regulated is private school in Hawaii?
You know, there's no regulations other than our accreditation, which is, you know, and that's something that's a whole new subject that'll take a long time to talk about. But
so it sounds like what Stefan Molyneux often refers to as horizontal policing, where people are comfortable within a sort of institutional context because they say, oh, this is what's done to me. And then we always have that hard time. And I've seen a lot of older people have a really hard time with it was good enough for me, so it should be good enough for my children. We don't have that attitude when it comes to medicine or technology or anything else in our lives, but when it comes to how we treat our children, all too often for too many people, that seems to be a common sentiment. John, you used the phrase, and I'm just going to pot you down because I'm getting a little bit of feedback. When you said the phrase freedom within the institution, I looked at Kirk. Because Kirk has two kids,
awesome. Yep.
Wise beyond their years. But how old are the girls?
I've got an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old.
And they both go to public school. So the freedom within the institution is not always an option. But a lot of that, I think freedom is in your head as well.
I think so, too. Yes. And, you know, John, one of the things that you said that I thought was just terrific, it's a work in progress. You haven't nailed a solution down. But in your own life, you talked about finding, you know, the writings of Gatto, and, you know, that happened well after your college career and while you're already into your teaching career. So obviously, you know, the real hope here, both for our kids and for ourselves, is that we never nail it down, that we're always learning and we're always progressing. There's always new stuff out there. My kids, both of them started out, you know, learning at home, and we did stuff, you know, obviously lots of reading to them and counting and, you know, baking things, which is a good math exercise and also delicious. And then they went to a private cooperative school that's very Piaget based. And then when we moved to New Hampshire, we decided to go with the public school system. And part of that was because our kids were leaving very active social lives back in Michigan. And they said, you know, we want to meet the new kids where we're going to be. And there wasn't really a good private school in the town that we were moving to. And part of it was because, well, we did some research on the school system, and you know, we were fortunate enough to find a place that has a semi-private high school. So it caters to boarding students from all around New England, but it also has public school students from our town and a couple of surrounding towns. So it's a little bit different than your typical public school environment. But
because of what's, I mean, so much of it too, it has to do with what's going on at home, and your kids are certainly prepared
right.
to be in a place like that. And you said they kind of find it, they're not intimidated.
No.
And they probably find a lot of it pretty comical.
They do. They have fun with it. And I guess, whether they're blessed or cursed, I guess is, you know, anybody's judgment to make, but, with some of my sense of irreverence and, you know, my oldest daughter does something that I think is awesome, but it's something that I learned in business meetings well outside of school. If she's in a class and she brings up a topic and she doesn't feel like the teacher is giving it enough time, she just walks up to the board and writes "to be discussed later" and makes sort of a bullet point list of the things that she wants to talk about later. And she doesn't disrupt the class. She just gets up, puts it on the board, and sort of serves notice to the teacher and everybody else. I'm not done with this yet. You know, we're not letting this thing go.
And how does that go? Does that work?
You know, when she first started doing it, there was one teacher who was extremely positive and another teacher who was extremely negative. But to her credit, she took the positive and sort of brushed off the negative, which is as much a part of her personality as it is anything else. But she's just continued to do it to the point when she left elementary school and went to middle school, I found out later that the principal of the elementary school went to talk to the principal of the middle school. And he said, "Listen, you're getting this one student. Here's what her name is. This is a thing she does. If you go with it, it'll be great. If you try to fight her on it, she'll win."
I think it's really important for you know, anybody who has to send their kids to public school or that they want to go or whatever, is just to instill in them the idea that they're right most of the time. You know, they need to just be aware of what's going on. And I think you and Michelle really instill that in your kids.
Well, you know, I think one of the things, too, is I see with a lot of people, whether they are liberty-minded parents or whether or not they are sort of on the extreme conservative end of things or the extreme liberal end of things or whatever they want to classify themselves as. There's a lot of sense of, you know, well, they taught you this way and that's wrong. My way's right. Or yes, your teacher's right. But it's not a matter of right or wrong. It's a matter of the thought process and helping those kids learn how to think for themselves and how to take the information that they receive from a quote unquote authority figure, whether it's a teacher or a parent or a boss or a bigger kid in the school, and break that information down and do some research on it, and figure out, is this information correct? How do I want to handle this information? How does it apply to my life? Those are just basic life skills.
This is some good advice you gave me too when I was preparing for my speech at Porkfest. Don't be the new argument from authority. Right.
Yeah.
So most parents will, and from my experience, a lot of parents are really lazy about this, and they're just like, yeah, the teachers are right. Do what the teachers say, or they'll take the side of the teacher unless it's some kind of really egregious, like disciplinary thing that happens at the school.
Right.
But certainly on content delivered, even conservative parents really don't meddle too much from my experience. But yeah, don't be the new argument from authority. They need to think for themselves. So, John, thank you very much for your call. This is Cool Sucks Live. We will be right back. 843-JOIN-SSP if you want to give us a call.